I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. Yesterday, I Googled happiness and psychology, and these headlines popped up. The 7 Habits of Happy People. The Science of Happiness. Can smiling make you happier? And my favorite, the British amateur who debunked the mathematics of happiness. Our guest, comedian Paula Poundstone, wanted to find the secret to happiness, so she made herself into a kind of happiness guinea pig. She rented a Lamborghini for a day. She took dance and taekwondo lessons, not at the same time. She went camping with her daughter. She worked on getting organized. She meditated, spent a whole day and most of the night watching TV with her 3 kids. She wrote about her observations and her findings in her new book, The Totally Unscientific Study of the Search for Human Happiness. She is a stand-up comedian. She's a regular panelist on the NPR quiz show, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, and she's sitting across from me, and Paula Poundstone. A great pleasure. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. There are many emotions you could have researched. Sadness, fear, surprise, disgust. You chose happiness. Why?
I think I'm going to do a book about surprise. I love
that
idea.
Wouldn't that be good?
Yeah, I'll just have people constantly jumping out at me until I'm a nervous wreck.
Why happiness?
Well, it's fun. That's the main reason. I think although a balance of all emotion, of course, is the healthiest way to go. I think the one that we're hoping we score big with is happiness. Plus, I just thought it would be honestly a really fun playground in which to write yet another memoir. I get to keep writing memoirs because I'm not yet dead. And so that gives me permission. And the question that I started out with was not whether or not I would enjoy doing any one of those things. I had a vague suspicion about what I would enjoy. But the real question was, what thing gives a lasting feeling where there's some shelf life to it or provides an umbrella to the inevitable rains that are a part of everyone's daily life.
Indeed.
I mean, the truth is, if you're happy all day long, then you're likely daft.
There's something wrong with you.
More than likely. It isn't something that comes in 24-hour cases.
Well, I will get to all of that. I'd love to have you actually read a section from the book where you decide to take taekwondo classes. The little post-it is there. You introduce us to your teacher.
Mr. Victor King was the instructor. So I found this taekwondo place not too far away from my house, and I went down there to check it out before I made my move. Mr. Victor King was the instructor. He did a rapid pretend assault on these women, and they successfully deflected his blows, following up with a series of elbows to an inch before his nose and knees to an inch before his groin. They looked pretty advanced. They must have been learning to almost hit someone for quite a while. As a driver, I'm a natural at that. I was really intimidated watching them do it with hands and feet, though. I harbor a fantasy that since I don't like sex and therefore never seek it, perform it, look for it, dream about it, dress for it, hint about it, or purchase products that are sold by suggesting that if you own this thing, you'll get more of it, there must be some other unknown, untapped skill in life for which I have a gift. Deep down, I was hoping that, especially because I'd be an unlikely candidate, I'd do a kick or two and this Mr. King guy would say, "Whoa, I thought you said you had no prior training." "That's right," I'd reply. "Well, Miss Poundstone, is it? Normally, I start my students off at a beginner level, but I'm going to ask if you'll teach with me. I simply can't believe that you haven't kicked the stuffing out of a padded thing before."
That's Paula Poundstone reading from her new book. Where to start with that? I'll get to the part where you say you don't like sex. But how did things work out with taekwondo?
Taekwondo was great. It was grueling. I was up to doing 500 jump ropes.
That's impressive.
No, rope jumps.
Rope jumps.
Yeah, and that's in a row. I'll tell you one thing I figured, even now, and I haven't been doing, that was the get fit experiment, the first one in the book. I haven't been doing any kind of working out stuff in a long, long time. And just as I suspected, the weight that I lost came back and brought its friends.
I think you said you lost something like 12 pounds.
I did lose 12 pounds, yeah. And I really did feel good. And so it's natural to ask oneself, why then don't I just work out?
Right.
Right?
And you'd feel better.
I would feel better. It's, you know, it's the cheese. It's not even a maze. It's a straightaway to the cheese. Just here it is. Come get it. First of all, in terms of working, I really do have to have someone tell me what to do. It is just, there is no way that I'm going to jump rope until I'm about to vomit without someone else being my overlord.
I just, saying only 10 more, Miss Poundstone, right?
Yeah, I just couldn't push myself that hard. It wouldn't even occur to me to do so. I would think, oh, since I'm about to vomit, I should stop, which I think is a natural thing that your body gives you. And so, yeah, you need to hand your brain over to someone else when you're working out. I think, for me anyways.
Well, it's funny you say that because I did sign up for a gym once, and I used to drive home by the gym, and I would look at it out of the corner of my eye, and I would just keep driving.
Yeah, just pretend you don't see it. It's not there.
It's not even there.
Well, you look fantastic, so whatever you're doing, you got to be doing something right.
Well, let's talk about the don't like sex part. Is that true?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's just not my area.
Was it ever your area?
No, actually. Have I experimented? Yes, I have. About every 10 or 15 years, I do an experiment, and so far I'm right.
This doesn't mean anything to you?
No, it really, and I'm happy for the rest of you. Don't get me wrong. It's not like a prudish thing. There's just too much, I don't know. It's a lot of stuff. And it seems that I function so well without it. Why, you know? And, you know, the thing is, I don't even know how. You know, I am so busy and I work so hard. I mean, now my kids are young adults. But honestly, for years, I was a single working mom with, you know, various amounts of cats, like 16 cats, 2 German Shepherd mixed dogs. We had bunnies. I had one aunt left from my aunt farm for the longest time. The idea that I would go into my room at the end of the day and there'd be someone in there with whom I had to have an activity was just upsetting to me.
Are the cats a good substitute then?
Well, actually, I don't allow the cats in the bedroom. there's got to be one place where someone hasn't, you know, peed in a place they're not supposed to, and there's not, you know, fuzz all over everything. So I don't allow them in my bedroom, but I do sleep with 2 German Shepherd mixed dogs.
Keep a person out of your bed, right?
Yeah. Well, I don't even have a bed. I sleep on the floor with blankets.
Truly?
Yeah. I sleep on the wood floor. So
is that left over from some ascetic period in your life?
No. Since high school, I just have much preferred the floor. In a hotel, like I'm staying in a hotel tonight, I stay in the bed in the hotel, but because I don't know where their floor has been. But at home, here's why. Because in the morning I get up and I fold the blankets and I put them in a box. If that bedding were out all day long, I would never get out of it. So this way here, it's, you know, out of sight, out of mind, and I'm on with my day and I work really hard. But if I had like a nook or a cranny to lay down in, that would be the death of my productivity.
Well, let's talk about the fact that you, when your kids were little, you did not allow them to watch TV.
I didn't.
Ever? Well, it was very, I mean,
no,
kids
I,
are very good at sneaking around on this
oh,
stuff.
Oh, surely too. They did. I think when Allie would go to a friend's house, she would cheat. And by the way, I did that when I was a kid. My parents, when I was little, tried to do a rule where we could only watch on non-school nights, and I would just go to my neighbors. And by the way, they had, now back then there were only 3 television stations. Except for there was another one. Remember, like UHF or something
like that.
Right?
Yeah. It was local rabbit ears and all that.
It was local programming, and we didn't get that station on our TV, but my neighbors did, and so I would go to their house and watch, you know, black and white Superman and really not particularly high caliber stuff. So I was well aware that my daughter was cheating. But overall, in our house, I told them they could watch the television. They just couldn't turn it on because we had one. But we watched – it wasn't really a holier-than-thou thing. I didn't. First of all, we were really busy. We kept a really busy schedule. And so there wouldn't really have been room for that to begin with. It would just be something to have to constantly say, hey, get away from there. We got something to do. But the other thing is, and I have maybe mixed feelings about this now, I really didn't. Well, first of all, most of what's on TV is terrible. That's one thing. And the other thing is the advertising. I didn't want them seeing all that advertising. But you know what? I may have made a mistake there. By the time I was in the second grade, I had a healthy cynicism about advertising. Remember, like stuff would come on and you'd elbow your friends and go, yeah,
that's
right.
That's not true.
Yeah, exactly. Well, my kids never had that. My son Thomas is like an advertiser's dream. He would tell me something about a product. He'd go, like, that's the very best car there is. And I go, well, what makes you say that? And he'd go, well, they said so. Like he was just...
if the not cynical enough to deal with our...
So maybe I made a mistake.
Consumer culture.
Yeah, exactly. And I wish I could tell you it made them great readers, but it really didn't. But anyway, we did watch like DVDs or videos on non-school nights, so they knew more about movies ever than they did about television shows.
You did, though, as one of your happiness experiments, say, okay, kids, we're going to basically have a TV watching marathon.
No, we didn't watch TV. We watched movies.
I mean, watch movies.
We did
yes.
watch one or two. We watched a couple of shows that were on DVD. Yeah. Well, you know, I had been planning the various experiments for years. This book took place over the course of several years. And so I had this idea that we would all watch movies, which because we didn't watch anything during the day and because I was very strict about what they could watch, this was a very exotic idea to us, to all of us. And they were very excited about it. They were always asking when we were going to start that experiment, you know. And most of them didn't include the kids. Most of them I did on my own. So finally we come to the time where I decide we're going to do this. And I'll tell you, it's so backfired in so many ways.
And we're talking hours after hours after hours, putting in a new movie.
It was like a marathon, like to a grueling degree. It was like a pie eating contest, you know. There was a gluttony about it. It started out, you know, what normally, you know, a slice of pie would be lovely, maybe if you're really cheating too. But if you're, you know, choking down slices and slices. In the beginning... first of all, I let them, you know, this was back when Blockbuster was still open. And so I stupidly said that they could go choose from there as opposed to from our massive collection at home. And they just chose some deadly, awful stuff. So that was part of it. And they sort of did it in a, you know, it was a, they used their film choices as almost weapons against the
like
other.
Like Cinderella,
watches.
Right.
Yes, exactly. My oldest daughter chose Cinderella, which is the only Disney movie that I loathe, and she knows it.
Paula Poundstone, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. She's got a new book. It's actually a memoir, and it's also a faux scientific examination of happiness, the totally unscientific study of the search for human happiness. And you can join our conversation. You can call or text our comment line, 267-405-2006. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Artie Moscoane talking with Paula Poundstone, stand-up comedian. She's a regular panelist on the NPR quiz show Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. She wrote a memoir a couple of years ago, There's Nothing in This Book That I Meant to Say, and she's got a new memoir, The Totally Unscientific Study of the Search for Human Happiness. I should also add she was the first woman to host the White House Correspondents' Dinner, and she won an American Academy Award for
I believe it's not an Academy Award. No. I'm fairly certain.
If I could read my own writing, that'd be helpful. I will do this again. She won an American Comedy Award for Best Female Stand-Up. We'll work on that Academy Award.
I was so excited when you said it. I thought, oh, my gosh. It must have been in absentia. I must have been really good in something. What could it have been?
Let me play a clip from Paula Poundstone's 1990 HBO special, Cats, Cops, and Stuff.
I'm kind of suicidal. I tried carbon monoxide once. It wasn't really working because my building has a big underground parking garage. So it was taking a really long time. I had to bring a stack of books and some snacks. people come by and tap on the window and go, how's that suicide coming? Pretty good, thanks. I felt drowsy earlier today.
And again, a clip from a 1990 HBO special, Cats, Cops, and Stuff. Paula Poundstone, I'd love to have you read a section from the book where you decide to rent a Lamborghini for a day, for I guess a 24-hour period. And
well, my original plan was to rent it for a week, you know, because I thought that's where you'd really get a sense of it if you had it for a week. But when I went online and found this site where they rented, you know, fancy cars in Beverly Hills, and the pictures of the cars come up, and there's this big numbers underneath them, and I thought there was some sort of serial code or something that you click on to tell them which one you want, and then on closer observation, I realized, oh no, that's a price. Oh my God, it was these huge, you know, commas, so I thought, well, for a week though, you know, that's I guess I could, you know, maybe that's not that bad for a week, and then I get the guy on the phone to, you know, talk to him about renting the car, and he's like, no, that's for a day. Oh my gosh! So I had to, I had to shrink my expectations. So anyways, if I pick a night that I'm going to do this, I was on my way to an acting class, and so I figure, well, I'll go to the place and I'll pick up the car on my way, and so I go into the fancy car rental place, and here we go. The woman handed me the keys. And seconds later, I couldn't figure out which of my 6 cargo pants pockets or 2 sweatshirt pockets I had put them in. Still, she had 2 very sweet instructors walk me out to the small parking lot to show me the Lamborghini. I attempted to look nonchalant while getting into the driver's seat. The driver's seat was quite low, though. Thanks to public toilets, I have enough balance and thigh strength to get down to about a 95-degree knee bend, but after that I dropped into the seat, making a graceless plopping sound. I didn't have the leg or core muscle strength it took to then lift my feet into the car, so I scooped my hands under my thighs and dragged in all that was attached to them, like lifting an anchor to set sail. Kofi, one of the instructors, was already in the passenger seat waiting to familiarize me with the vehicle. It never occurred to me that there were any special operational instructions, but there were.
The taekwondo didn't help with that.
No, nothing helped. Nothing helped with that. Every time it was like my legs were paralyzed or something. I scooped them each time I got in and out. The instructions. I mean, that I had just never thought about, that there were details to it any more than driving my dented van.
Well, I was going to say, what do you normally drive?
A dented van. with Pop-Tart crumbs all over the floor and, you know, soda cans all in the back.
But you do have a really, I have to say, lovely scene where you take your son out driving the Lambo, the Lamborghini, the two of you together.
It was the best part of the whole thing.
And that was a moment of happiness that the two of you shared, a moment together.
It was. It may have led to less happy moments. Maybe I was giving him the wrong message to begin with. By suggesting to him possibly that such a thing would make one happy. My son was, I think he was 16 or so at the time, didn't have a license, hadn't so much as gotten a driver's manual thing to study, had no permit, nothing like this. And I call him up because I thought I'd make it a surprise that I had run in this car. So I'd made my way to the acting class with the car, and during the break in the acting class, I go and I call my son, and I said, you know, guess what? And I said, you know, I rented a Lamborghini, and he was so excited. He was like, oh, you did? He thought this was the greatest thing in the world. And for a moment, what a stupid mom am I? For a moment, I thought, oh my gosh, I've made my teenage son happy. I was thrilled for a brief moment, and then he said, can I drive it?
Well, of course, right?
Yeah. And it was just like, wait a minute, this really great, fun thing, and you find a way to find a negative in it, you know? And I just was so stunned by that. I was like, drive? No, you can't drive it. Maybe I didn't react the right way. And then he went back to that morose teenage thing. Fine. All right. So when I got home that night, he sort of pretended that he didn't care. But when I got home that night, he came out to look at it. And I said, well, run in and get your jacket, get my jacket, and come back out. And with the top down, it was, 11 o'clock or so, and we drove around Santa Monica, mostly making rights, by the way, because I really don't enjoy a left. And we drove around Santa Monica, both of us trying to act cool and sort of laughing at one another because we were recognizing that one another was trying to act cool. It really, that was a fun, nice time. And then it was pretty much downhill from there.
Right. Well, those are those little moments of happiness that you write about. And not to get super serious here, but you do find, I think, what others have found, which is the giving of yourself, volunteering, putting others in,
It's such bad news. It's really bad news about what makes you happy.
It's a nice reminder of the kind of simplicity of it in a certain kind of way.
Well, some of it is this biochemical thing. Like, you know what? Here's something. Sleep. Now, I did not experiment, in fact, with sleep. Here's why I know about the sleep thing, because of the Get Wired chapter. There was a chapter where I came to computers later than many. I learned to use a computer just about the time Twitter was becoming a thing.
Right.
I went out. We had a big computer in our house. I just didn't know how to use it. My kids could use it, and my assistant used it, but I didn't know how. So everybody kept telling me, particularly because I had written a book by hand. My first memoir I wrote by hand. I would hand the pages to a typist. And then I wrote three math workbooks with my high school math teacher. They're called Math with a Laugh. And the entire time I was working on those projects, people kept saying to me, oh, you'd enjoy this so much more if you had a computer. You'd be so happy if you had a computer. So, and I didn't think so, but I decided that it was a legitimate experiment. So I went out and bought a laptop, which I always say, I bought a laptop because you can carry a laptop door to door and beg for help, as opposed to the big kind where you have to lure someone into your house,
right.
Which
I always dangerous.
Jeffrey Dahmer ruined for everyone. So I buy this laptop and I did what a lot of people do, which is, to start the Facebook thing. And what's interesting about the chapter is because I was pretty much a blank slate. Hopefully my field notes are the funniest field notes ever written. But the truth is, I did keep very careful field notes. And so one can actually see this kind of steady decline my whole life was disrupted by that machine, just the way it has disrupted the life of every user. And for a lot of people, it's a frog in a pot, and they sort of don't really remember how they used to be anymore, and they don't notice the agitation that it's caused them, the way that other things in their life have lost importance, including, I was shortcutting on making the kids dinner. I was.
Because of your devices or this particular device?
Yeah, because I was so involved in making little films for Facebook and trying to post things and checking, the constant checking. I started doing Twitter, same thing. I check that thing every checking my email. If I checked my regular mailbox that many times, my neighbors would do an intervention. And the truth is, it's not like I'm even expecting anything. So I began, and my sleep got disrupted, because I would wake up in the middle of the night and check.
Well, I should add something to your sleep habits in that you drink, and we got you several cans of Diet Coke. Well, you have your own Diet Coke.
Where is it?
We will bring in other cans of Diet Coke.
Tell the Sherpas to get in here with the...
But you keep a can of Diet Coke by, and you're just downing it as I ask you, by your bedside. Yeah. So how do you sleep anyway if you're downing caffeine all day?
You know
long?
What? It doesn't. I think I have to drink a lot of caffeine to even get to ground zero.
Really?
Yeah.
Just to kind of get revved up.
At one point I had the. I remember years ago, I had the flu when it was going around, and my kids had the flu, and I took care of them, and then I fell prey to it myself, and everybody else recovered within a couple of days, and for me, Even though I was still functioning and doing what I had to do, I was exhausted. I could barely make it off the floor. And I finally realized that, you know, one of the things that happens when you get the flu is things don't taste good anymore. Right. It's part of the reason you don't eat so much when you have the flu is it just doesn't taste good anymore. So soda didn't taste good to me anymore. So I had stopped drinking diet soda. And I realized, okay, it's not that I'm sick anymore.
You need
it's,
your caffeine.
I am having withdrawal.
Wow.
And it's and as soon as I realized that, I had a good head start on kicking the habit, but I you know I also had terrible headaches and stuff, and so I thought, you know what, forget it, and I just pounded it and was right back in the. It takes me several doses of caffeine to even be like a normal person.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
So it doesn't the stuff I drink at night doesn't keep me awake.
Well, it's interesting because when we were just confirming your appearance today, when we called your people or your publicist, they said, well, make sure that you have Diet Coke for Paula Poundstone.
Oh.
And we do. So just so you know.
By the way, I'm not that bad. I don't, everywhere I go, people don't have to hand it to me, although I love that idea. I should have told her that I needed rubies.
There you go.
Make sure you have rubies for her.
We did have a guest once who said he would like to have grapes. We were unable to. I think we were able to produce that somehow. But anyway,
wow.
Paula Poundstone is our guest. She's a long-standing stand-up comic. She's a regular on NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. And she's got a new book. It's called A Totally Unscientific Study of the Search for Human Happiness. This is a kind of a serious question, but do you think comedians are more or less happy than anyone else?
No. I think that's an old wives' tale that that comics love. I mean, when I first started, I was so dramatic. I really bought into that idea that, you know, somehow it was the tears of a clown and that I had somehow suffered more than most. It was a rather pathetic notion, actually. No, I think if you want to find unhappiness, get a coal miner or someone who's just born into the world with a genetic predisposition for depression. I mean, a lot of depression, can it be caused by certain things? Absolutely. But it is also a condition that some people are just genetically, you know. So, no, I don't think that comics are any more unhappy. The truth is, in fact, I think the opposite might be true, which is because the job that we do, regardless of what our normal state is, the job that we do is we get to go on stage and say things that we think are funny and be with a group of people who've come out to laugh for the night. And I can't really think of many more uplifting experiences. And I consider myself a proud member of the endorphin production industry. And you really.
And we appreciate that.
Well, yes. You get a contact high from it, that's for sure, you know. So, no, I don't think we're more unhappy than others.
But you do write in your book, negativity is practically my native language.
Well, that's
true. Where does that come from?
I don't know. I think maybe I just have allowed it more than others because I was watching an interview last night on the NewsHour with a soprano diva. A big one in New York, I guess, that is not going to do
Fleming,
that.
Somebody.
Yeah. And she was saying that she was talking about stage fright and that she, and this is a woman, you know, couldn't be more accomplished in her craft. And she was, and I don't know if she was saying she still had it, but she was talking about the times at which she did. And again, all that training, you know, you don't become an opera star without a tremendous amount of training. So you got, you know, as a comic, the training is that you go on stage and you do open mic nights and you, so you have to really be bad at it in front of people.
And that's how you learn to be good at it?
Right, exactly. As opposed to being something like an opera star. Now, I realize performing in front of people is different than not performing in front of people. But as an opera star, you would have the training that goes into it before you hit the stage. So there would be a reason to have some confidence in what you're doing. But what she was saying was, basically what I took away from it was just what a part of the human condition, that is.
Sure.
Have a feeling of inadequacy, and people handle it in different ways, but I think we all have it.
You were, what, about 19 when you did your first stand-up routine? What was the routine, and what got you in front of the mic?
Well, I had wanted to be a comic, you know, for as long as I can remember, literally since kindergarten. I didn't know how to go about doing that. And really, I was very lucky. It was really just sort of time and place that a comedy scene began in Boston in the time while I lived there.
Wow.
I was bussing tables for a living. It's not like I turned my back on a law degree. I had wanted to be, you know, Carol Burnett or Mary Tyler Moore or Gilda Radner I'd want to be a comic actress. I still would like to do that, actually. But I didn't know from stand-up. And then I went with a friend to a club one night where there was a band playing, and there was a flyer on the wall saying that every other Sunday there was a comedy show there at this place. And so I went, and I saw that, and it wasn't very good, by the way.
No,
because those guys that were on that had really just started a couple of weeks ago. You're not very good in a couple of weeks. It takes a lot. I'm an ascriber to the Malcolm Gladwell theory from Outliers, the book Outliers.
Yes.
He says that in order to be an expert at something, it requires, well, obviously access, so you are able to do the thing to begin with, but also the attitude with which you do it, and then 10,000 hours of practice.
Yeah, practice.
And so, you know, in 2 weeks, you're not a very good comic. But anyways, I went and I saw, and so I joined in and began doing open mic nights, and that's how you get good at doing this job.
And that is Paula Poundstone, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. You can join our conversation. You can text or call our comment line, 267-405-2006. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join the conversation. Much more to talk about after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Paula Poundstone. She has a new book, The Totally Unscientific Study of the Search for Human Happiness, in a sense using herself as a kind of happiness guinea pig. She's a regular panelist on the NPR quiz show Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, a longtime stand-up comedian. And here's a scene going back to Bravo TV's Funny Girl special. This is 2006, Paula Poundstone. And I should say, because you can't see it, because we're on the radio, she's lying on her back, her feet are up on the air, on a stool while she talks.
I often wish that I had a degenerative disease. And I'll tell you why. I'm tired and achy all the time anyways. I don't think I'm going to feel any worse, but if I had a degenerative disease, the exact same behavior I have now would be considered courageous. I could roll out of bed about noon and somebody in the other room would whisper, "She insisted on getting up."
And again, that's Paula Poundstone going back to 2006. So I'm sort of imagining your very first stand-up routine and what it took to get to that.
Oh, yeah. I wasn't quite that relaxed in my first stand-up routine. I talked about taking public transportation. I was bussing tables in Boston at the time, so I talked about bussing tables. I talked about my working at the International House of Pancakes.
Oh, there you go.
And I don't remember what else. I'll tell you what. One thing that I started doing from the very beginning, when you did an open mic night, the premise of open mic is that anybody who wants to can go on for 5 minutes. And especially back then, those nights, those open mic nights, were the hottest night of the week. The crowds were hotter than even on a Saturday. And they would be like a Monday or a Wednesday. And partly because it was a deal for the audience. There was either no cover charge or it was very low. And every comic wanted practice time. So they were just these raucous, crazy nights. Both I eventually went to San Francisco, but in both cities, same deal. And so many people were waiting to get on that if you went over that 5 minutes, I mean, you could hear the knife sharpening in the back. And I would memorize my act. If you watched me bussing tables during the day, you could see my lips moving because I was memorizing my act all the time. And you know, I'd type it out on the backs of obsolete menu placemats from the restaurant that I worked in, and I'd go on just really intending to do just that. And what would happen was I would get so nervous that I'd forget what I was going to say, and then I was stuck, you know, improvising basically. Or on my way up to the stage, even I would see something in the room that I thought was funny, and then I would blurt it out. And now, right off the bat, I have no idea where I am in the 5 minutes,
right.
And which would only make me more and more nervous. And so I kept thinking to myself, because it made everyone so mad when I would go over, that this was a terrible, terrible thing, that I wasn't sticking to my set. And I don't remember on what night or even what year it dawned on me that the real joy of what I do is when I don't stick to the set. So I got to a point where I allowed myself that freedom. I allowed myself to do stuff like lay down on the stage. But it took a while. I don't remember how long I had been at it before I really embraced it was a little bit like Dumbo.
Oh, with the feather sort of jumping into the pool?
There's a great line in Dumbo. It's something, you know, I gave my manager, who's the greatest manager in the world, I gave her a copy of a Disney, you know, big picture book of Dumbo years ago, because Timothy Mouse was a fantastic manager. Oh. He says to Dumbo, when Dumbo ends up in the tree in the morning, and they don't realize right away what's happened, but then they figure out that in their drunken stupor, at some point Dumbo must have flown into the tree. And he says to Dumbo, when he realizes what happened, he says, the very thing that brought you down is going to bring you up, up, up. And so that was sort of, I figured that out somewhere along the way myself, which is this inability to stick to what I was supposed to say, which felt like a negative for so long. It turns out that's where the heart of the whole thing is. And when I work, I do have an act. I have many, many, many jokes. I've been at this for 38 years, and I think a lot of my material is pretty darn good. But the real joy of the evening is just talking to the audience. I do the time-honored, where are you from, what do you do for a living? And I allow whatever the person says to set my sails.
That's so interesting, because I've been in the audience where the person on stage is looking to someone to talk to. And I always say to myself, oh, please don't call me. Please don't call me. Please don't call me. It's like, I'm not here. I'm not here. But for you, it's unfortunately, our guest has got a terrible, terrible cough.
I'm so sorry. And they have no cough button.
And I have the cough button, which doesn't help her at all. Oh, jeez.
In radio, there's a thing where there's a button you can push when you cough. Well, I have a chronic cough. And so on. Wait, don't tell me. Half the time, my cough button is pushed.
Well, I mean, it's interesting to think of improv, because it seems to me improv is obviously about being in the moment, but it's about listening, it's about observing, it's about being sort of ready to go with whatever happens.
Yeah.
That's how I think of it anyway.
I think you're absolutely right. And people ask me about it all the time. They go, oh, I just can't believe you can do that. Well, you know, the truth is we do it all the time. You do it in your work. We do it when we speak with one another, which, by the way, we're less and less good at in life in general, because I spent the last couple of days in New York City, and I hadn't been there for a while, and I just could not get over every single person on the street. That's an exaggeration. Okay, 95% of the people on the street have headphones in or are staring at their flat thing. And why would you bother moving to a place or even visiting a place that's packed with people and then spend all your time trying to get away from them? It makes no sense whatsoever. You know, we should live... We are wasting our greatest resource, which is one another. People should walk down the street like the opening scene in Beauty and the Beast. It should be bonjour, bonjour. You know, it's so important to make contact with one another and have spontaneous conversations. That's what we do all day long, or what we're supposed to be doing, is just talking to each other. So I, whenever people ask me about it, I go, well, actually, everyone does what I do on stage. And part of it is just, again, allowing it and then having the little bit of confidence, I guess, in myself, knowing that I can sort of talk myself into a corner and then find a way out.
What's a good show for you?
Well, I like to talk about things that I think are significant, and I like to talk about things that are totally insignificant. I like the crowd to go away feeling like they are part of a whole, and part of that is just, you know, shared laughter. My favorite, you know, I remember years ago, my son sort of busted me. It just dawned on him one day. He said, Mom, do you talk about me on stage? Uh-huh. And I, you know, I had never told him that I did. And I was like,
he was going to find out, you know.
I guess. Yeah. I don't know. I was like, I said, yeah, actually, I do. And I said, and he sort of took umbrage. And I said, you know, the truth is, Thomasy, if our experiences were totally unique, then people wouldn't laugh. They would just stare at me like I was a freak. I said, but, you know, I said, the struggle of being a mom, or even the struggle of being a little boy, are not unique to you and I. And the part of it that is really, really hard when you tell it to someone else and you feel like, oh, and they respond, that laughter of familiarity, the laughter of recognition. I go, you know, it just makes everyone feel so much better. And I said, so, you know, I said, the truth is I exaggerate a lot of things. It's not like you do everything exactly the way I tell it on stage, or it's not like I do either. And by the way, when I talk about my children, it's not the story of my children being screw-ups. It's the story of me as a mom not having yet figured it out, but that feeling of we're all in this together is, and I talk about politics sometimes on stage. I'm a Democrat, and I think I talk in such a way as that one would recognize that I am a Democrat. But I always say to the audience, I say, look, if I'm not talking about your exact political viewpoint, I can assure you that if you bear with me for a few minutes, we will find common ground within the evening. There, we all have far more in common than we have differences. And if that's not good enough, then, you know, then every now and then somebody gets mad and leaves. But, you know, we do. We have far more in common than we have differences. Mm. And the sooner that we recognize that, and the sooner that we recognize that we are pack animals and we need one another, the better off we'll be.
There's something else. You write about your kids in the book. You've mentioned them in our conversation. And you write about some of the worries that you had, as you said, some of the mistakes you feel like you've made as a parent. And, of course, we've all made them. But you also talk about the fact that you were in a residential school as a teenager yourself, what, around age 17?
Yeah. Yeah, I was a big screw-up. I was very depressed, just sort of a miserable oaf of a child. And eventually I got sent to, you know, one of those programs that they have for kids where really they have no idea what to do with them, and so they sort of wait for them to time out.
Was that to observe you or to therapy?
No, it was like a therapeutic program. Wow. Yeah, I had stopped. I continued to go to school, but I didn't go to classes anymore, and I just was very, 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 very unhappy. And so I went to this place. It was in, you know, a residential program in Massachusetts. And, you know, what's funny, years later, I wanted to go to, I thought I wanted to go to college at one point. And so I got my transcript, and because I completed, you know, quote unquote, completed high school at this residential program. And so I get the transcript and I look, and I had gotten a B in gardening, according to this transcript. And I thought to myself, well, wait a minute, I don't remember. I didn't take gardening. And then I was like, oh, no, we did have to weed the garden one day.
And you got a B.
How did I get a B in garden weeding? And I think it was because I asked to go in for a glass of water. And that's it. That drops your grade in gardening. But
did this school help? In hindsight?
In hindsight, it was a really screwed up place in lots of ways. But it was probably – it was sort of a holding bin while you aged. And I'll tell you, I met some really wonderful people there. I don't think anybody had any answers about how to, you know, solve this problem or that. But I met some really great people there, including a person I mentioned in the book, a woman that was my best friend for years, was a staff member there. And then she introduced me to her boyfriend's family, who became my family as oh, wow. I aged. And yeah, so it wasn't a bad thing. I don't have regret that I was there at all. It was an adventure. You know, it was a lot of groups and
it's a tough time. 17 years being a teenager.
There's huge stretches of years that are tough times. Honestly, my middle daughter's 23 now, and I find myself saying to her all the time, I go, you know, it will get better. Early 20s aren't all that joyous either, really. You know, it's a time of really unsure footing about how to get to the next place. And I think I can't even explain to her how a lot of the things that I've been able to do were so serendipitous that I don't think I could say, well, you do this and then you do that. You know, to some degree, you just throw yourself in the water and you meet somebody. You know, it's not a linear path.
Let me read a couple of emails. One from Dave says, most comedians seem to come from the northeast part of the U.S. Do you have any theories as to why you think this is true? First of all, do you think it's true?
I don't think it's true. You know what's freakish? Dick Cavett and Johnny Carson come from Nebraska.
That's true.
Right? Go figure that. How did that become the hotbed of comedy? Certainly Boston had a great comedy scene, and New York City has a much more long-standing comedy scene. So I think more than that, they came from those places. They went through those places.
An email from Bob. I had to wait a few years until my schedule finally allowed me to see Paula at the Sellersville Theater a few years ago. You actually write about your performance there.
Sellersville, yeah.
It was a birthday present to me. Enjoyed it very much. Made sure not to sit too close to the stage, knowing that she likes to pounce on some unsuspecting soul in the audience. Good to hear you.
I think pounce on someone is not the right term. Involve. I prefer.
Call on.
Yes.
Right?
Share with. I love talking to audience members. I have had the greatest conversations. I had a lady the other night sitting up front. In fact, I was at the Barnes & Noble in Upper West Side, and there was a book event thing. And there was a lady in the front row, had a little dog with her. And it turned out, I asked her about the dog. It's a service dog. She is mortally allergic to kiwi. And that dog is trained to recognize if there's kiwi in her food.
Wow.
She thinks.
How often do you have kiwi in your food?
Honestly,
right?
Do you even find out you're allergic to? You know, when I was growing up, I was allergic to, I outgrew these allergies, but I was allergic to chocolate cheese, chicken, tomato, and grass, which are very hard to avoid when feeding a child, I think. I don't think a kiwi allergy is difficult to live with.
Well, on that note, Paula Poundstone, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
This was so quick.
It was so quick.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're very welcome. The book is The Totally Unscientific Study of the Search for Human Happiness. And Paula Poundstone will be at the Free Library of Philadelphia tonight, I believe at either 7 or 7:30. And that's it for today's edition of Radio Times. Our engineer has been Al Banks. And the show is produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Artie Moscow. Wayne, thank you so much for joining us.